Greetings and good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is November 30, 2018. It's an overcast and drizzly day here in Nashville. However, the temperatures have warmed up some, and so it's quite tolerable. We are back from a Thanksgiving break, and we have scheduled two programs in quick succession between now and Christmas. As always, if you want to keep up with the new programs, subscribe to us on iTunes. That way you will get a notification when new programs are posted. We also post notifications on our Facebook page. We are now approaching 2 years of doing this podcast, and we've done 25 previous episodes. I'm grateful for the new friends we have met and for the positive feedback we get for our programs. I have been fascinated for years with the story of the American chestnut tree. Once a dominant tree in the eastern North American landscape, it has been decimated by a fungal blight, which somehow hitchhiked into North America from Europe or Asia. Today we talk to forester Tim Phelps from the Tennessee Division of Forestry. Tim serves as the outreach coordinator for the Division of Forestry, and in his work life has had a significant interest in the American chestnut tree and its rehabilitation. Tim has served on the board of the American Chestnut Foundation, and so he brings us up to date on what's going on to revitalize the chestnut tree. Because forest health has been topical in the news these days, we also take the time to talk about the emerald ash borer and other invasive pests which are affecting our Tennessee forests. And so, I hope you'll enjoy our interview today with Tim Phelps. So, Tim Phelps, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's really great to be out here. We're out here today at the Ellington Agricultural Center here in Nashville at the Tennessee Division of Forestry headquarters. And it's kind of a gloomy day here in Nashville, but glad to be out here speaking with you.
That's right. Typical fall day here. Wetter than normal, but we're happy to do that. It's keeping our fires down, so we're always pleased to have that happen.
Tim, we're here to talk today about forest health, and I want to talk about the chestnut tree and some other things that are topical in that area. But
yeah,
before we get into all that, I'd like for my listeners to hear a little bit about your background and particularly how you got into conservation and forestry as a career, and maybe your childhood experiences that influenced that or whatever.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think my story is not atypical of a lot of other foresters in the profession. We have a passion for being out in the woods. We like dealing with trees and forests and managing them and telling the story of the woods to people. A lot of folks might recognize that, you know, we like to be out in the woods and communing with nature, but really a part of what we do is very socially based. You know, we tell our story to our audiences, and that's often landowners, it's municipalities, it's really whoever wants to listen. So we like sharing the story of the woods. So I got into it, I started my college days as an engineer, and quickly realized I really didn't want a desk job. I didn't want to do something like that. So as much as I enjoy some components of that. So I kind of followed my dad's lead. My dad was a professional forester.
He was a professor
of forestry at Southern Illinois University, where actually I ended up
going to school there, yes.
Yep. So I switched to that. His background was wood science, and he could tell me all about the ins and outs of the inside of the tree and the materials that you can make out of wood and the great things that we, the benefits that we get from wood. My focus was more on the outside. I liked the interrelationships of trees and the soils that went into growing certain species of trees and even the herbaceous plants that were associated with it. So more of a forest ecology realm than his background in wood science. So we still get together and talk a lot about forestry, and he shares his interests and passion from the wood side, and I share my interests and passion from the forest ecology side. I've got my master's and bachelor's both at Southern Illinois University, and really was intrigued with that interrelationship of plants and how we can go out. It's almost like forensic science, where you walk into a woodlot And many foresters are trained in this. You read the landscape and can kind of get an idea of the history of that. So it's almost forensic science in a way, just by looking at a stand of trees and saying, well, here's what probably happened 100 years ago,
right.
And here's what's going to happen over the next 100, 200 years, if let alone, or what potential could be there for certain benefits that it could provide, whether it be wildlife, aesthetics, just recreational aspects, or even timber. So that's what really got me into it. And I know we're going to talk a lot about chestnut today. And one of the inspirations I had in my bachelor's program was an insects and disease class.
Okay.
And I still remember the assignment very well. Our professor handed out and said, here's a list of topics we want you to write a research paper on. And everybody gets one chance, you know, we didn't want to duplicate topics. And I quickly saw the chestnut on there. I was like, you know what, I've heard about this little foundation that's doing, it's a grassroots foundation to try to bring back this species from its current demise, and I thought that was a really interesting story. So I jumped on it, learned a lot about it, and it stuck with me. Just happened to have a lot of luck after I graduated in landing a job that dealt quite a bit with the restoration of the American chestnut. I know we're going to get into that.
But okay.
So it was that inspiration of that particular species and that story behind the demise and potential resurrection of this species that really it drove my passion for this profession.
Super. Well, I was directed to you by several sources, and it mainly had to do with your connection with this American Chestnut Foundation and the Tennessee chapter of that organization. So
mm-hmm.
You got yourself involved with that in a pretty big way.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're the job you were referring to, was that the job at Penn State that you were working
at? It was,
okay.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
During my master's program in Carbondale, Illinois, Southern Illinois University, a fella took over a position that my major professor had. He retired, and a new guy came in. He came from Penn State, and I was in my second year. I was looking for jobs. And his position, since he had just left it, was available. It was a very interesting forced genetics-based related position. It also had some silvicultural aspects of it. Silviculture in the forestry realm is basically the art and science of practicing forestry, how to grow trees culturally. So it had some really neat aspects to it. It was kind of far away from home, so that was an interesting thing to consider, but went after it and landed it. So that particular position at Penn State University, took me across the country in a land I hadn't really had much familiarity with, and a much bigger school than what I graduated from. But it was a research technologist position that primary responsibility, about 70% of my job was related to chestnut restoration.
Really?
Wow. We also worked with genetic testing of some other hardwood species like oak and black walnut and ash, just looking at tree improvement, essentially. But I also got heavily involved with growing Christmas trees. Christmas trees is a major industry up in Pennsylvania.
Sure.
I think it's like the fourth largest producer of Christmas trees in the nation. So got to learn all the science and art of growing a stand of Christmas trees, something I might retire and do. It's one of those skills I would love to practice now.
Well, if you're going to retire and do that, you need to be planting the trees
this
week,
that's right.
for use 15 years from now.
That's right, yes.
Let's jump ahead and let's just talk about the chestnut tree. And
sure.
I think probably it's safe to say that many people that are listening will not know this story. Give us the thumbnail sketch of the history of the chestnut
sure.
tree as a problem or
right.
as a
yeah. It's a common, more of a common problem now with a lot of other species that we know of. If folks have heard about the emerald ash borer, which hopefully most of your audience has heard that. Because it's affecting Davidson County right now. We can get a little bit more into that later. But if you are aware of that problem, chestnut blight sort of set the stage for what we are experiencing now with a lot of insects and disease issues that are born from basically pathogens or insects from other countries. So the chestnut blight, and while several people nowadays haven't heard about it because it happened so long ago.
Well, there are no chestnuts on the landscape out there, or very
few. Not as many.
Very few.
Right.
What would an American chestnut tree fully developed look like?
Well, historically, and this goes back to the ecological significance of it, was the most dominant tree in our landscape, primarily on the drier sites, so on our ridge tops. And it spanned all across Tennessee. The old saying goes that chestnut was so dense in our forests in terms of its frequency, so many of them. A squirrel in Georgia could get all the way to Maine without ever leaving the branch of a chestnut tree. They were that frequent. They were just everywhere. In fact, another adage is that because of their pollen, it's kind of a white puffy pollen that comes out around here in late May, early June. Looks like snow cloud in the forest. But in Tennessee, you know, they were probably most frequent out in East Tennessee, but they were definitely around here in the Nashville area, primarily on our hilltops, where it's drier, and they dominated. They're fairly shade intolerant. Shade tolerant. They can tolerate a little bit of shade, but when they get light, if the canopy opens up and it's a younger plant, it will explode and grow as fast as a yellow poplar, which is one of our fastest growing hardwood trees in the state.
And they would be as big as our big stately oak trees are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. They could get to be. In fact, some of the old historic photos, especially from Cove Forest, where they're also cohabitated with like eastern hemlocks in your like the Smoky Mountains
area. Sure.
There are pictures where they're 5, 6, 7 feet in diameter, just amazingly huge trees. So it was very important back then, again, as a very frequent tree, common tree. It had so many uses for folks. It is incredibly rot resistant, so the wood was used for anything in your house related to millwork, decking, flooring, cradle. In fact, it was considered a cradle to grave because cradles were made out of it, and so were grave boxes.
Okay.
Fence posts, very rot-resistant wood. In fact, if it hadn't had its demise, we very likely your deck might be made out of chestnut wood.
Rather than redwood or something.
Exactly. Yeah. It's right. So rot-resistant. It was also very easy to work. Woodworkers loved it because it kind of had a soft feel to it. You could kind of turn it into anything. So from a wood point of view, it was just an amazing species. But also from a wildlife point of view, and even a farm point of view, it produces such a large crop of mast, the seed, the nut, the chestnut itself, each and every year, and very reliably so, that wildlife frequented it on it. It wasn't uncommon for farmers to release their hogs out into the woods to go and feed on the chestnuts during the season. So,
and people would eat them.
So the chestnuts roasting over an open fire.
Right.
And that story kind of leads us into its demise. It was that holiday season affinity for the chestnut to be a part of the holiday season that we started bringing in other species of chestnuts that were foreign, specifically European and Asian, Chinese chestnut and Japanese chestnut, and establishing orchards. Chinese and Japanese specifically have a little bit bigger nut than our American chestnut has. I think arguably ours tastes better. Maybe I'm biased, but it is a little bit sweeter. But when they brought over the Chinese chestnut, it had co-evolved with a fungus that we now know as Cryphonectria parasitica, otherwise known as chestnut blight. That fungus could impact the growth of a Chinese chestnut tree, but the Chinese chestnut tree had evolved with it and developed defenses against it. So it could be infected with the blight, but it had mechanisms. It had the ability to essentially wall itself off from the otherwise growth of the fungal pathogen on the tree and survive. Well, when they started bringing the Chinese chestnuts over and making orchards out of them here in the United States in the late 1800s, it of course brought that blight with it. and our American chestnut, which is a very close cousin of the Chinese chestnut, had no defenses built up against it, against that fungal blight. And this is a common story. That it's the same thing with emerald ash borer. It's the same thing with hemlock woolly adelgid and all these other. That's how I make that connection.
Right.
So when it was really first detected or first given its name in the early 1900s, there was a series of chestnut trees in the New York Botanical Gardens that they detected and said something's wrong with this, and eventually realized that it was this fungal pathogen. And within about 50 years, it swept through the whole native range of the chestnut, again, Georgia to Maine, all the way over to Oklahoma and Texas. So within about 50 years, the spores of this fungus are largely wind-derived. People moved it around. It moved around in various ways. Several things were done to try to stop its spread. In fact, in Pennsylvania, they tried to create a miles-wide swath clearing of forest, thinking it might not jump from one area to the next, obviously failed. But a lot of things were done to try to stop its spread, and nothing worked. But back in the 40s and 50s, genetics was the answer. Let's try to breed some resistance. The thought was breeding resistance into these trees. If we know that Chinese chestnut is resistant, perhaps we can breed that resistance into American. And we see this kind of breeding, these traditional breeding practices in a lot of crops. You know, look at most people's gardens, your tomatoes that you grow today.
Sure.
Your corn that you grow. It didn't occur that way thousands of years ago, but over time, humans learned tricks to breed preferred traits of plants and recreate them over time to get that preferred fruit or for preferred growth. So, some really smart people back in the 40s and 50s started looking at trying to breed in resistance to this tree to bring it back. And they had some marginal success at that time, but nothing that really solved the problem right away.
So how are we doing today in the program of trying to breed in that resistance?
A little group called the American Chestnut Foundation was formed in 1983 to pick up on the work that had been done in the 40s and 50s. In the 40s and 50s, it was largely done by two groups, the Connecticut Ag Experiment Station and the USDA Forest Service, and they worked collectively together. And primarily what they were doing was they were taking these closely related species, the Chinese chestnut and the American chestnut, and trying to breed in that resistance from the Chinese into the American. They ended up creating some good crosses. However, when you make crosses like that, you're not just inheriting that one trait. You're inheriting lots of traits. And our American tree is much different than a Chinese tree in terms of forest hardiness. Our American species grows very tall, very quickly, and is very straight. The Chinese tree is more of an orchard type tree. It's usually multi-stemmed. Doesn't grow as hardy in our forest. So what the foundation decided to do, and through some genetic work, a lot that was done in Minnesota with corn and other agronomic crops, was to integrate what was called this back cross breeding method. And this gets into a little ninth grade biology lessons. If you remember Mendelian genetics, where you have a white flower mixed with a red flower, and the dominance of what kind of color flowers you get out. Well, there was a lot built into what we were looking for. And what they discovered was that, with that example, you would think, well, you're either going to get progeny that's white or red. But what they were finding, there's a lot of pink. There's a lot of mixture in there. Okay. So it was a lot more it's a lot more complicated than what they originally thought. So that ended up sparking a full-fledged back cross breeding program where we took some of the most successful progeny that they created in the 40s and 50s, which was a 50% Chinese, 50% American tree, back crossing that with a pure American so that its progeny is then 75% American, 25%. And you do that a number of times to a number of back crosses to where your final result is in the upper 90 percentile of American and just a small amount, all the while selecting for that Chinese resistance to the blight. And it can be done.
It takes a long time.
Yeah. Agronomists do this with corn and rice and other annual plants all the time, and they can turn over these back crosses quickly. With a tree, they don't flower the first year usually. Now, fortunately, with chestnut, they're a fairly precocious plant. They flower at about age 3.
Right.
If we were looking at red oak or some of our other oaks, they don't flower until age 15. So the process can get very long with trees.
Right.
And that's been one of the hindrances with the overall program. But after 35 years in existence now, the Chestnut Foundation has gotten to that 90 percentile tree. It's called, on their spreadsheet, it's called a B3F2. It's been back crossed 3 times and then forward crossed to try to eliminate that pink color and get to more of a pure resistant color. Are having some really good successes with it. Now, it's not completely blight resistant. There's still a whole lot of testing that needs to be done. And there's a bunch of different interesting ways that the foundation is working with interested individuals, landowners primarily, that want to grow some chestnut trees. And some of that is producing more orchards to produce more back crosses. Or also looking at the progeny that our most advanced material is producing, putting it into the woods and seeing it, how it performs. In other words, how much of that other Chinese material is still ingrained in the DNA that may inhibit its ability to thrive in our woods. So some really neat things that are being done with what I think we could accurately call traditional breeding techniques, where we're just taking two plants, crossing them, and trying to enable a desired trait and push it forward. So a lot of that is going on within the range of the foundation. And what's also interesting is our New York chapter with the American Chestnut Foundation took a little bit different approach. And they saw the back cross breeding method and saw that as a viable solution, but something potentially faster and almost ironically more pure, which is to use more of a biotech format, which is basically taking a gene from a closely related plant. In this case, they took wheat and found a gene that inhibited the production of certain chemicals that the blight produces, which eats away the tissue of the plant. If they could inject that into the DNA of a pure American tree, potentially it could make it resistant. And so that's where some of the research is going right now. And there's a lot of great, if you just Google the biotech chestnut, there's a lot of really cool literature online about it, and they're having really good success with it. And some of the purists out there would say, well, you know, biotech isn't, you know, why does it not have, where is its place in all of this?
Right.
And that's a court of public opinion. But when you look at the overall DNA of what we have with the Black Cross breeding program versus that biotech, the biotech version is much more American potentially than the
Black Cross version. Yeah, because you can go directly to the issue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But they both have their place, and I think both are showing really good signs. One of the things that amazes me, and going back to my college days, that amazed me about this story was the grassroots nature of the foundation. It's got a lot of scientists behind it, and the science of breeding and silviculture. But it's also just got a lot of very passionate people, many of whom had remembered the demise of the chestnut when they were kids. A lot of those folks are no longer with us. They've aged and passed away. But the story continues, and we're still making headway. So it's a really neat project.
Is there a place for the average citizen to involve themselves in this in some way, or let's just say a master gardener or someone who's very much interested in gardening?
Sure.
To involve themselves in this sort of a thing.
Yeah, and the foundation has a website that describes a lot of these ways that they can participate. If you're a larger landowner and wanted to participate and have a breeding orchard, that's an option. That takes a time commitment of generally 10 to 12 years, and obviously a space commitment on your property.
Right.
But if you're just a gardener or a general hiker that's out in the woods, we're always looking for new flowering chestnut trees. There are still quite a few chestnuts on the landscape. It is not threatened or endangered. We typically call it ecologically dysfunctional, because it doesn't have the same functionality that it had in its dominant days.
Right.
But there are still millions of seedlings out there. I've walked through Warner Park and seen many of them around the park in there. They exist. However,
I've never seen them in Warner Park, I have seen them in the Great Smokies many times.
Yes.
As you say, up on ridgetops.
Right.
And a lot of times they're younger sapling that have come up from the down tree, down tree, and they may live for 5-10 years and then they're
exactly.
gone again.
Yes, and that's one of the benefits of the plant biologically. It sprouts, and in fact, if we're talking about it from a forest harvesting point of view, the wood used to be cut. And regeneration was always through what we call coppice, which is sprouts from the stump.
Okay.
It has the inherent ability to, when it loses its main stem, to sprout a new trunk from the roots that exist, which is a really beneficial feature for the resurrection of this tree, because those genetics are still in place through the root system. And eventually they get to a stage where they flower and can produce that way. So most of the ones you find in the woods anymore, they don't typically live more than 10 to 20 years.
Okay.
In fact, 10 is pushing it.
But you're looking for people to be spotters for those
yes,
sorts of things.
And not so much every plant, but especially flowering ones.
Right.
Because, again, it goes back to the value of the genetics of that species. What's out there in the woods right now is a historic repository of the genetic DNA of American chestnut, and we want to maintain that over time, especially as we integrate that into breeding programs. It's not going to be beneficial for us to restore a tree. We have to restore a forest. So if we say we magically get one specimen that is totally resistant to blight, you can't reforest our forests with one genetically modified tree, one genetic superior tree. We have to have a whole bunch working together to prohibit certain genetic factors which could otherwise wipe out any population that we create with it. So we're always looking for more diversity in the DNA of the trees that we find to integrate into the back crossbreeding program.
So interesting. The I have been interested in this topic for a number of years, and I guess it's been 5 or 6 years ago, I purchased two chinkapin chestnuts.
Uh-huh.
Now, those are kind of a cousin of the great American
sure.
chestnut. I mean, as you know, they're a smaller tree. They're shrub, almost shrub-like.
Mm-hmm.
Itty-bitty little chestnuts on
right.
them. But I have a couple of them in my front yard, they're good to eat, actually.
Yeah.
They're very, very flavorful.
Super tasty, absolutely.
Can a person purchase a chestnut tree, a standard chestnut?
Well, if you join the American Chestnut Foundation, there are some protocols in place for receiving some of their material.
Okay.
And, again, it's kind of what you want to end up, what level you want to participate in. If you want to be a grower for a breeding program, that's available to you to do. Material still owned and monitored by the Chestnut
gotcha.
Foundation, so
gotcha.
Whatever comes off that eventually is still the property of the Chestnut Foundation. But that's just to ensure the integrity of the overall program
right.
over time.
Right.
We anticipate, though, as these more advanced orchards that have multiple sources and diversity of DNA in them, as they evolve over time, and they're evolving now. There's some of them are 50% through completion of building and selecting for resistance levels. When those start producing nuts, that's the next phase, is to try to start reforesting.
Getting them out there.
Getting them out there in the woods,
wow.
exactly.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah.
Well, this is a lesson that we need to learn as a society about how we take care of our woods and what we are allowed to bring into this country. Is it not?
Well, it's certainly a common occurrence. You know, the chestnut foundation or the chestnut blight was really one of the first that caused a great bit of interest in, and was an obvious circumstance of really what can be boiled down to global trade, right? And so if we wanted to get really serious about it, stop global trade. I don't think that's going
to
happen.
Yeah, well, we just need to be more thoughtful
more,
about
more thoughtful about yeah. what moves around and how it's moved around.
Right.
And in many ways, we're speeding up some of the processes that happens in nature anyway. It's not uncommon to have drift of genetics or drift of species from one continent to
sure.
another that eventually
sure.
you get naturalization. Look at privet and honeysuckle right now. As bad as you and I probably see that, a lot of our residents maybe don't see it as a problem. It's fairly naturalized, and it's not going away.
Right.
Emerald ash borer is another good example of that. That's been in, at least detected in our country since the early 2000s. It was probably here well before that. And it's moved through the native range of ash, just swept through, because it has no predators. Because it was brought in and basically was allowed to do its thing across our ash forest that had no defenses against it. And there's no stopping that. And it's going to be a naturalized bug at some point. We're just going to wave up the white flag, and that's just the reality of it. There's nothing. We cannot get rid of it. So all that to say, we have several examples that have shown us what has gone wrong because of global trade, because of moving certain things around that, yeah, ideally it would make us examine what we bring and how we move things around a little bit more strenuously. And there are measures in place to do that. There's just so much volume that the practicality is a challenge. But it's definitely a fight that has to stay up.
So what are the other things that are out there in the landscape today? Now, we've talked about chestnut blight, but then there's the emerald ash borer, I guess the hemlock. There's
the hemlock woolly adelgid, right? Yeah, there's gypsy moth. There's thousand cankers disease. Thousand cankers is kind of an interesting one. It affects black walnut, and it's a forest health threat. It's a combination. It's much like Dutch elm disease.
So there's another one.
And that one swept through the 70s and early 80s, and we figured out some neat things around that. Largely genetics. You can get some good American elm varieties out there that are fairly resistant through the great genetic work done there, but. Yeah, so thousand cankers actually is it's like that, because that Dutch elm was a bug that carried a disease, and thousand cankers is the same way. But they think that some of that's native, but native to the Southwest. So it's all a question of then what is considered exotic. Typically, we consider an exotic invasive as being from a foreign land that
right.
is outside of the continent of North America.
Right.
But in a case like thousand cankers disease, we're looking typically within the our continent, but in a much different ecosystem. And you know, there's one really common vector in all this of how this stuff moves around, and it's us, it's people.
Sure.
So there's things that we've tried to do as an agency. By the way, I don't think I mentioned this early on, but I work for the Tennessee Division of Forestry. And we do a number of things forest related, particularly on the protection of the forest, and forest health is a big part of that. And we've tried to get messages out about firewood. Firewood especially is a means of moving some of these invasive species around from one place to another, essentially giving them a free ride in the back of your pickup truck when you go camping.
Well, yeah, the bug will get up under the bark of the firewood that you're trying to move, and
right.
all of a sudden you've infested your neighbors with whatever bug this is.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So there's those programs, and they've State Parks now has
exactly.
a policy. Smoky Mountains has a policy. Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Army Corps of Engineers, same policy. Essentially, if you cannot bring firewood into those properties unless it's certified heat treated. And they provide certified heat-treated firewood typically at those facilities. So an example of what turned in from messaging to sort of a policy point of view of how we can control this And there are those tools. Quarantines are usually the first tool that's implemented to try to reduce spread. But, you know, quarantines are largely message-oriented as well, just to raise awareness of where these problems are and try to work with industry and others to reduce their spread. So a number of tools kind of at play that we can try, but ultimately it is outright prevention of bringing these things in that is our best defense.
Exactly. So, Tim, if an ordinary citizen wants to be kept aware of what's going on in this realm of what's forest health, let's just call it generally.
Sure.
Is there a Facebook page or a place where they can tune in to, and they'll be regularly fed this sort of information?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. We started a number of years ago. Actually, it was born out of the emerald ash borer and thousand cankers outbreak in 2010 in Knoxville. Several agencies and nonprofits and universities got together, so we need to elevate our message around this. And that was where Protectian Forests was born. It's a messaging campaign that started out as a simple website, protectianforests.org, that's still up. We're actually about to do a major renovation and launch that soon, so it'll be a little more interactive and lively than its current site. But we have social media channels built around that as well. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And it started out, like I said, mostly forest health related, specifically emerald ash borer and thousand cankers disease, but it's evolved to include other forest health issues. Lots of bugs and crud out there in the woods, but you know, forest health also is affected by wind and tornadoes and hurricanes, and you know, we don't bear the frontal blow from hurricanes, but we certainly feel after effects as it sweeps across the state with wind and abundant rain. So there's a number of factors that go into affect forest health, and in fact, it's a fairly nebulous term. It's got a lot that's kind of built into it. And some of it is honestly it's just a perceived condition of what we want the forest to look like. So all that to say, we talk a lot about on Protecting Forest about the bugs and crud, but we also try to integrate what homeowners and landowners can do to make their trees and forests healthier. So no one division, no one university or nonprofit organization can fix the forest. In Tennessee, a vast majority of our forests, which covers 50% of the state, is owned by private landowners. So one of the things we do as a division is to try to work with those landowners and let them know, hey, you're a steward of your property, and there's things that you can do to not only make the forest healthy, but also to meet your objectives of owning that property, because you're just owning it for a short period of time. If it's wildlife, if it's maybe recreation, maybe it's for timber, even beyond those primary objectives, it's your management decisions of your property affect society as a whole through clean air, clean water, and those types of things. So we try to work with our landowners to help them appreciate and understand that there's things that they can do to better manage their property and meet their objectives, and all the while making the more healthy forest.
So protect TNForests.org.
That's correct.
And if you search for that phrase on Facebook, it'll also
yes,
come up as a Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lately, because of the California wildfires that we've had an awful lot of talk about wildfire prevention.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And that's related to forest health in a major way. What's going on in Tennessee with regard to forest fire prevention?
Yeah, so that's also an ongoing...
That's a topic we could spend a couple hours on.
Sure.
Here, certainly.
And there's several pathways we could take on.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, still fresh in many folks' minds, especially those east of us, is the fire season
Gatlinburg.
Of 2016.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was Gatlinburg. Gatlinburg was really a catastrophic bookend to an already historic fire season. We were having fires from September through the end of November, which is when Gatlinburg happened, but starting in September, especially around the Chattanooga area that year. So that was a That was a mega year. That was a career-defining year for many of the firefighters in our agency because they were out working every single day managing fires going on all over the eastern half of the state, really. And conditions like that will return. There's no doubt about it. It's just a matter of when. So the last couple of years, though, since then, have been fairly moderate to light. In fact, this fall season is extremely light. We are on track right now to have a historically low number of fires throughout the calendar year.
We've had abundant rain this fall.
We've had abundant rain since spring. Right. It's been a pretty wet year all around, and certainly weather helps. Now, after saying that, fire prevention efforts help as well. And because of the fall fire season, we've had a lot more interest by homeowners, especially those homeowners that live in what we like to call the wildland-urban interface. That is the not so much a urban or suburban area, but kind of hitting on the fringe of our forest where fire is a natural part of that ecosystem. And it's going to return time and time and time again. Fortunately, we're lucky in Tennessee and really across the Southeast to have most of our fires are low creeping ground fires. They're not like the huge fires, mega fires out west where they're sweeping through the canopies of trees. They're typically on the ground. As a result of that, there's a lot of things that homeowners can do to protect their home and be that first line of defense from a wildfire, keeping their yard clean, keeping the leaves and needles off their rooftop and out of their gutters, not putting their wood stack on their deck, keeping it away from, keep in mind when there is a fire, embers blow, and typically in a calmer wildfire, they're going to rain down. In a more extreme condition, like what happened in Gatlinburg and like what happened in California recently, you had winds that were just blowing sideways. Yeah, yeah. There's no defense against that.
Right.
There's things that you can do, but number one in that category is get out, evacuate. There's things that we like to promote to our homeowners, and we work through a series of programs. FireWise USA is one of the bigger ones. Which is a program that a whole community can get involved with, because really it's not just any one homeowner protecting their home, and that's a big part of it. It's a community working together that can have the greater impact, and FireWise USA program helps do that. So
interesting. So interesting. Well, Tim, I want to thank you for making yourself available to talk today, and perhaps this will be the beginning of several conversations with you about forest in Tennessee.
Absolutely. We appreciate your audience for being ambassadors of this message and helping to spread it and for you to put on this program. So anytime you'd like to have me back, I'd love to come back.
Thanks, Tim.